Hello. Welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, July 5th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour of the reading by reading the list of names in the obituaries. Andrew Dwayne Holleran, known as Andy. John Albert Lasota, Jr. Albina Lawrence, Suzanne Laby, Robert Maynard, Sean McLean, and Sandy Steinhilber. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the people that we just listed. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. There are two articles in this section of the paper. The first one has a large, probably at least a half the page, and covering three columns, but from top to bottom, at least half, maybe more. It's a picture of Benjamin Franklin, and the column on the right says, "A Grand Experiment." This article was written by Khachatur Manoukian, from the University of Notre Dame, in their paper called The Conversation. Benjamin Franklin understood something fundamental about money that still shapes modern economies. Money only works when people believe it is real. In the early 18th century, the British colonies suffered from a chronic shortage of gold and silver coins, forcing local governments to rely on paper bills for trade and everyday commerce. But paper currency created a dangerous new problem, because unlike metallic coins, paper money could be easily copied, altered, and faked. Long before his experiments with electricity, or his role in the American founding, now 250 years ago, Franklin spent years working with paper, ink, and printing. And in that process, he developed a practical understanding of materials and manufacturing. Nearly three centuries later, modern scientific analysis reveals how sophisticated some of his anti-counterfeiting strategies were. My colleagues and I in material science recently analyzed hundreds of surviving colonial American bills, including notes that were printed by Franklin. Using modern imaging and scientific methods, we examined the fibers, the pigments, the microscopic structures hidden in the paper. The results suggested that Franklin approached currency as a practical materials problem. Although paper money originated in China more than 1,000 years ago, it did not appear in Europe until the 17th century. And by the early 18th century, the American colonies lacked enough gold and silver coins to support a growing economy. So, in order to keep commerce moving, many colonies began issuing paper money instead. But paper currency also created anxiety, because the colonial bills were relatively easy to fake. Forged notes circulated widely. Printers even put variations of the phrase, quote, "to counterfeit is death," unquote, on colonial money, and detailed harsh punishments for counterfeiters in their newspapers. Now, Franklin became involved in money printing in the early 1730s, soon after establishing himself as a printer in Philadelphia. During his career, Franklin printed millions of pounds worth of paper money for Pennsylvania and several other colonies. In 1749, he brought in the printer David Hall as a business partner. Hall carried on the practice with William Sellers after Franklin left the practice in the mid-1760s. Franklin also created a network of printers in other colonies, supplying them with printing presses, paper, and ink. This network printed paper notes for the Delaware, New Jersey, New York, Maryland, and South Carolina colonies. Printing money required greater precision than printing newspapers or pamphlets. Franklin understood that a bill's physical characteristics and the materials used to prepare it could shape whether people trusted it. Franklin approached printing as a craftsman, constantly experimenting with new printing techniques and materials. Colonial papermakers produced paper sheets by pulping old linen and cotton rags in water, then lifting the suspended fibers onto screens and compressing the wet pulp by hand. So under magnification, this old paper resembles a dense network of tangled fibers. Franklin explored ways to make his bills harder to copy by embedding additives into the paper. Some notes included indigo-colored fibers or threads that were mixed into the pulp. Those innovations forced counterfeiters to reverse engineer the paper, not just the printed image. Franklin also experimented with imitating designs from natural objects. For example, by pressing leaves into soft material, he captured complex vein patterns with high precision, and he later printed those patterns on colonial bills, producing designs that were difficult to copy because no two leaves shared the same structure. Franklin had written a famous pamphlet to advocate for paper money, though it did not record his exact techniques. Alongside his main account book, he kept a separate ledger that has never been found to record dealings with the papermaker Anthony Newhouse in 1742 and 1743. In the mid to late 1740s, he purchased money paper from Newhouse. Now, historians have speculated that Franklin was developing this new money paper with Newhouse and separated the accounts to keep its security features confidential. So when my colleagues and I began investigating nearly 600 colonial bills, we wanted to understand the materials they contained. We employed imaging methods capable of examining structures thousands of times thinner than human hair. Those techniques allowed us to reveal the chemical makeup of the inks, the fiber colorants, and the mineral particles used. Some findings surprised us. Franklin's black ink differed from many conventional printing inks of the period, which often used soot-based black pigment produced by burning vegetable oils or charring animal bone. Instead, many of Franklin's bills were found layered carbon structures, similar to graphite, the naturally occurring form of carbon used in modern pencils. Unlike soot-based pigments, graphite consists of stacked layers of carbon atoms that give it distinctive physical and optical properties. These results suggested that Franklin experimented with ink composition more extensively than historians previously thought. We also identified mica particles embedded in the paper. These particles reflect light, producing a faint shimmer. Whether added intentionally or introduced during papermaking, they created another visual feature that would have been difficult for counterfeiters to reproduce consistently. Under advanced microscopes, the fibers revealed differences in manufacturing techniques and paper quality and material preparation. What appeared to be a simple colonial bill became a complex engineered object under the microscope. Today, many banknotes contain similar particles, specialized threads, and layered optical features designed to deter counterfeiters. Franklin's materials were simpler than modern security technologies, but they relied on similar principles. Franklin never described himself as a materials scientist, yet his work on colonial money reflected many of the ideas that guide secure printing today. He understood that an object's physical properties could help build trust. The bill's texture, fibers, pigments, and printed details all helped convey authenticity. And that insight proved important far beyond the printing shop. Paper money provided a practical way to support trade, public projects, and economic growth in the face of coin shortages. But paper currency could only serve those purposes if people trusted it. So by making bills more difficult to counterfeit and easier to recognize as genuine, Franklin helped strengthen confidence in a financial system that supported a rapidly growing colonial economy. Modern analysis now reveals details that earlier generations could not see. Franklin's money was more than a financial instrument. It embodied a principled effort to engineer trust directly into everyday materials. And that's an idea that still informs the design of modern money. It is perhaps fitting that Franklin's portrait appears on today's $100 bill. Long before becoming one of the faces of American money, he helped develop some of the ideas that made paper money trustworthy in the first place. And that was the article, A Grand Experiment. Our second article from the economy section is entitled, Army Corps Program Offers Rapid Career Growth. This is written by Brandy Bufford for the USA Today. A shortage of more than 20,000 engineers by the year 2033 is the looming statistic published in the American Society of Civil Engineers 2025 report card on U.S. infrastructure. But the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Fellows Program is one slice of a larger pie of upward momentum in infrastructure planning. The USACE Fellows Program is the evolution of a World War II workforce development initiative to build an ecosystem of civilian STEM experts to lead critical infrastructure projects. As technology evolves and the workforce begins to experience aging infrastructure and retirement-driven workforce shortages, the Fellows Program is a pipeline for entry-level civilians to receive a variety of training in technical roles in engineering and science and real estate and logistics and contracting. Charisse Monsivius, USACE's career program manager, said, quote, upon completion of the program's two-year training cycle, cohorts are enabled to support leaders and the critical engineering and infrastructure missions, unquote. The entry-level training program recruits recent college graduates for positions nationwide and overseas. It includes the Corps' Europe and Pacific locations. Although the program primarily focuses on technical roles, cohorts receive a variety of training aligned within their field of studies. Samantha Boyle, a 2026 Fellows Cohort graduate, currently supports public affairs in the USACE Sacramento District. She said, quote, the Army Fellowship and USACE have both given me a great foundation for my career. From access to great leaders across our enterprise to supporting projects on dams, reservoirs, dikes, flood walls, and gates, and how they work together to improve flood risk management for roughly 500,000 residents, I see firsthand how our team at USACE Sacramento is delivering vital engineering solutions, unquote. Amid a rising workforce shortage for mission-critical projects, pipelines like the Fellows Program can bypass delayed hiring processes that could be typical to civilian employment. The program's Building Infrastructure, Not Paperwork initiative allows teams to deliver critical projects sooner and at less cost by eliminating bureaucratic delays, according to Adam Tell, who is the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works. Monsivius said, quote, we aren't focused on one specific pipeline, though it all contributes to healthy civilian workforce structure. We have a team dedicated to monitoring and forecasting hiring priorities, unquote. Those priority roles could range from mechanical, electrical, structural, civil, hydraulic, hydrologic, coastal, or cost engineers, up to biologist or geologist or economist or architects and real estate specialist, all of them working to support national priority infrastructure projects. The USACE has tracked the success of its program over the years. In the time since 2022, approximately 1,700 civilians have come through the Fellow Pipeline, with more than half being specialty engineers. Entry-level fellows are hired at the GS7 to G9 pay grade. That's roughly $50,000 annually. And by the 24-month program completion, they secure a GS12 pay grade of nearly $115,000. That's a promotion track that most recent graduates would work nearly 5 years to achieve. In addition to fast-tracking salary, fellows benefit from student loan repayment and tuition assistance, travel and rotational trainings, pension benefits, and flexible PTO. And that was the article, Army Corps Program Offers Rapid Career Growth. It's 16 minutes past the hour. We're going to move on from the economy section to the sports section of the paper now. As you probably have heard, the World Cup of Soccer is being played in the United States and Canada and Mexico. And this article from the sports section is all about one of the players, star Quinones, inspiring fans worldwide. It was written by Nadia Cantu for La Voz. Behind the footballer, now shining in Mexico's jersey, is a story of struggle and resilience. Julian Quinones grew up in Maguaypayan, a town in southern Colombia that for years was plagued by poverty, violence, guerrilla activity, and drug trafficking. Far from the bright lights of major stadiums and the spotlight of the 2026 World Cup, his childhood was shaped by challenges that made his journey to becoming one of Mexico's key players even more remarkable. Colombian by birth and Mexican by choice, Quinones was raised surrounded by women, his mother, grandmother, and three sisters. His father left the family when he was very young. Amid hardship, farm work, and a difficult family environment, football emerged as a chance to change his destiny. His talent quickly began to attract attention in tournaments, and while representing Colombia at youth national team levels, that potential opened the door for him to move to Mexico in 2015 and join Tigres, T-I-G-R-E-S, or Tigres. That's a decision that transformed his life. He arrived as a teenager, far from his family and homeland, but he found in Mexico a place where he could grow as a footballer and build a family and win titles and forge a new identity. Over the years, as he starred in Liga MX with clubs such as Tigres, Atlas, and America, Quinones did not receive the same level of recognition from Colombia's national team. Mexico, however, made him feel valued. He said to TUDN, a Spanish-language sports channel, quote, Mexico opened its doors for me to become the person I am today, and I believe the best way to thank them for everything is by playing for the national team and giving my very best, just as they have given so much to me throughout these years. Unquote. So Quinones, the boy who grew up facing adversity in Colombia and traveled to Mexico in search of an opportunity, is now one of El Tri's standout players at the 2026 World Cup, a footballer who represents power, determination, and a story of perseverance that resonates with thousands of Mexican fans. Now Quinones, who is 29, plays primarily as a striker, although he is also capable of operating on the wings, according to some other sports channels. Although he was born in Colombia, he built almost his entire professional career in Mexico. At the club level, Quiñones plays for Al-Qadsiyya FC in the Saudi Pro League. The forward joined the Saudi club in 2024 from Club America, and according to his transfer market profile, he is under contract through 2029. His career started with Football Paz in Colombia, where he developed through the youth ranks, then Tigres UANL, the club that brought him to Mexico in 2015, Venados de Mérida, where he played on loan, then Lobos BUAP, where he emerged as a prolific goal scorer in Liga MX, then Atlas, where he won back-to-back league titles and became a fan favorite. Then he went to Club America, where he also won a championship and further solidified his reputation as a star player. And now at Al-Qadsiyya FC, his current club in Saudi Arabia in Mexico, his spell with Atlas proved especially significant. He initially joined the club on loan before being signed permanently. With the Guadalajara-based side, he helped end the long championship drought by winning two consecutive Liga MX titles. And later, in 2023, Club America reached an agreement with Atlas to secure his transfer. Quiñones represents Mexico because he obtained Mexican citizenship and became eligible to play for the national team. The forward received his naturalization certificate in October 23 and was called up to the Mexican national team later that same year. His decision was driven by both personal and professional reasons. Mexico is the country where he established himself as a player, started a family, and achieved the greatest successes of his club career. Since arriving at Tigres in 2015, his career has been closely tied to Mexican soccer. The striker has said that representing Mexico's national team was his way of giving back to the country that gave him so much. For Quiñones, wearing El Tri's jersey was not just a football opportunity. It was also a gesture of gratitude toward the place where he was able to establish himself as a professional and build the life he has today. Quiñones also met his wife, Ana Gabriela Quiñones Amato, while playing for the Atlas Club in Mexico. After several months of dating, he proposed during a private dinner in November of 2022. The couple were married in a civil ceremony in December of 2022, and 1 year later they celebrated their religious wedding surrounded by family and close friends. They are also the parents of a 2-year-old daughter, Alana. Reports indicate that Colombia attempted to recruit Quiñones before his commitment to Mexico became official. During the peak years of his Liga MX career, the forward did not receive the same level of support or recognition from Colombia's senior national team, and that only reinforced his perception that Mexico truly valued him, giving him the opportunity to represent the country on the biggest stage of his career. In 2023, Medio Tiempo reported that the striker revealed he never even read the letter sent by the Colombian Football Federation while Mexico was also pursuing him. He told the newspaper, quote, "I always felt it in my heart. Colombia's representatives approached me, came to see me, and spoke with me, but I always told them no," unquote. The attacker ultimately chose Mexico and has since become one of the most important players in El Tri's plans. Quiñones' story has been completely transformed at this World Cup. The forward arrived as one of the most closely scrutinized and naturalized players and has since become one of the most beloved figures among Mexican fans. His goal against Ecuador in the first match of the knockout stage highlighted his importance to Mexico's attack and reinforced the belief that El Tri has found a special player, powerful, direct, fearless in one-on-one situations, and capable of making an impact in the biggest matches. Through Mexico's first 4 matches, he has a team-high 3 goals as well as an assist for a national team that spent years searching for greater attacking firepower. Quinones has emerged as an immediate answer. He has become one of the faces of L3 at the World Cup, with the story connecting two nations, but a present undeniably green. And that was the article, Star Quinones, Inspiring Fans Worldwide. Our next article is about NASCAR racing. Series makes return to Chicagoland Speedway. This is from Field Level Media. Shane Van Gisbergen restored his dominance on road courses Sunday and reinforced the fact that he is the greatest NASCAR road racer ever. But the stakes increase for the New Zealander during the second half of 2026. It's 18 races down and 18 races to go this season. And to the Trackhouse Racing driver's chagrin, there are no more curvy layouts to conquer. While NASCAR returns to the Chicago area this weekend, drivers will not be found again on Michigan Avenue. And that's a bummer for Van Gisbergen, because he won two of the three races held on the Chicago street course. Instead, NASCAR returns to the 1.52-mile Chicagoland Speedway, a tri-oval in southwest suburban Joliet, Illinois, that has not hosted an event since Alex Bowman earned his first career victory there in 2019. Sunday's Eero 400, which is a 267-lap that breaks the stretch of consecutive road races, it will be the 20th NASCAR Cup Series race at Chicagoland Speedway. Three active drivers have wins there. Brad Keselowski owns two, while Denny Hamlin and Bowman have won apiece. Keselowski's pair came with different manufacturers. Dodge in 2012, while he was racing for then the Penske Racing, and in a Ford for Team Penske 2 years later. Now, 42, Keselowski took the 2012 Cup title in the season he first won in Chicago, becoming the first Dodge driver to notch a title since 1975, when it was done by Richard Petty, who turned 89 on Thursday. Currently, in his 19th Cup season and 5th as part owner of RFK Racing, the Michigan native fended off rumors that his group will become Dodge's flagship team as the manufacturer returns to the Cup in 2027. Keselowski wrote on June 25th on social media, quote, "For those asking, RFK Racing has multi-year agreement with at Ford Racing and a commitment for their leadership to return the program to a championship contender. Any speculation elsewise makes for great internet talk, but it's not based on anything real," unquote. The number one comes up frequently regarding Ford, the Joliet Speedway, and the 2012 champ. Ford is a disappointing 1-for-18 in 2026, while the Blue Oval has only a lone checkered flag in 19 Chicagoland races. Keselowski himself has just one victory in 164 RFK starts, and that was a 2024 Darlington win. To use a football term, he and the manufacturer will be going for two on Sunday. In a similar vein, Van Gisbergen will be going for two on Sunday. While all of his 8 official NASCAR wins have come on road courses, he won on an oval last July in the summer shootout at Charlotte Motor Speedway. He recognizes that he will need more success on ovals to get where he wants to go. Last season, in 30 races on the tracks that were not road courses, Van Gisbergen posted an average finish of 24.8. Through 14 races on similar configurations this season, he has bumped it up to 20.9. Well, that's an improvement, but certainly numbers that will not make him a viable title contender. On May 31st, he scored his first top five showing by finishing 5th in Nashville. He will have to improve markedly to create more top fives. He opens the Euro 400 in 14th place, which at least puts him into chase playoff contention. The number 97 Chevrolet driver said Sunday of his win at Sonoma, quote, "It certainly helps us, but this is an oval championship." And that was the article, Series Makes Return to Chicagoland Speedway. We just passed the 30-minute mark in this hour of reading, so it's time to move on from sports over to viewpoints and read some opinions. So on the front page of the viewpoint section, there is an American Eagle standing under an umbrella, and the umbrella is the flag of the United States. And the title is Securing Our Votes, and there are two opinion pieces. So I'm going to start with the first one, written by Gary Restaino, a guest columnist, and his is entitled State Already Has the Tools to Keep Ballot Counts Honest. Here's what he wrote. 2 days after the local elections in March, and as the results were being tabulated for the Tempe election, security video shows that two employees of the Maricopa County Recorder wheeled a ballot scanner out of the county's tabulation center, loaded it into a pickup truck, and drove away. The Board of Supervisors also alleges that one of the men carried away provisional ballot affidavit envelopes. Misconduct by the people we trust to run our elections is exceedingly rare. But when it happens, it strikes at something existential. The public's confidence that the count is real and that every eligible vote was handled honestly. We can best protect democracy and educate skeptics through objective investigations predicated on reliable and verifiable evidence. Tina Peters, the Colorado clerk, who let an outsider copy her county's voting equipment, is the paradigm example of a rogue local official. She was convicted, served 20 months in prison, and remains a felon today. Peters also remains a hero to election skeptics across the country, including the president. And that is the harder problem facing honest election officials. Pressure to corrupt an election, or to shield those who try, no longer comes only from the fringe, but also from the top. So when the threat originates in Washington itself, what protects Arizona's elections? And the answer, reassuringly, is state law and public servants within Arizona. First, Arizona polices its own election crimes. It does not wait on the U.S. Department of Justice. State law makes it a felony to interfere with election officers or voting equipment, and to unlawfully carry away or conceal ballots and election materials. And it empowers the Attorney General and county attorneys, not federal prosecutors, to enforce those state laws. That's why the Maricopa County Attorney could open a criminal investigation and appoint a special prosecutor, former Pinal County Attorney Kent Volkmer. Volkmer has done exactly what we should expect from a prosecutor mid-investigation. He has worked quietly and declined to prejudge, a marked contrast to some federal officials in the Trump administration who telegraph charges or use their offices to sow distrust before the facts are in. Not every error is a crime, and the initiation of a criminal investigation demands articulable facts rather than partisan innuendo. Here, the video and the timing during the critical tabulation window supply exactly the kind of context the law looks for. Volkmer should provide a fulsome explanation of the evidence and his analysis at the conclusion of his investigation, and Arizonans should respect his charging decision. The recorder has now asked a judge to halt that investigation. That is the wrong tool. Courts can and should scrutinize subpoenas and search warrants, and they can review any eventual charges for vindictiveness or bias. But outright preempting a properly predicated investigation is not the judiciary's role. Second, and just as important, Arizona protects the honest insider. This same dispute is a reminder that an election employee can be pressured to do something unlawful. Arizona's public employee whistleblower law shields county election workers from retaliation when they disclose, in writing to an outside public body, a reasonable belief that they have been directed to break the law. Whistleblower laws, of course, are only as good as the people willing to enforce them. Arizona's Attorney General and the 15 county attorneys are in the best position to educate Arizona's public servants on how and where to file complaints and on the consequences of filing false complaints. Leaders like that are the difference between statutes on paper and elections that people can trust. Election officials and their teams are the first responders for democracy. Arizona should take comfort knowing that the safeguards protecting their work, independent state enforcement, real whistleblower protections, and leaders willing to use both, do not depend on Washington's goodwill. Even when the pressure comes from outside, Arizona holds the tools to keep its own elections honest. And that was Gary Restaino, opinion piece. He is the presidentially appointed and Senate-confirmed U.S. attorney in Arizona from 2021 to 2025, and he served in the Department of Justice for more than 20 years. And his opinion piece is entitled, State Already Has the Tools to Keep Ballot Counts Honest. Now, our other opinion piece is written by Mark Stewart, a guest columnist. There is a way to settle who runs Arizona's elections. Here's what he wrote. Arizona has a tremendous opportunity to modernize and improve our election administration while still respecting the constitutional roles of both the county recorder and the Board of Supervisors. Over the past year, Maricopa County has spent an extraordinary amount of time and resources litigating disputes over election administration duties between the county officials responsible for conducting elections. That litigation has highlighted the need for the legislature to clarify these responsibilities so election officials have the certainty they need to do their jobs effectively. By updating our election statutes, Arizona can establish clearly defined roles for the offices that oversee election operations. Regardless of the different stances on the lawsuits, Arizona counties should be able to interpret their basic operating responsibilities without relying on judges to determine how local election systems operate. What I know is that the strongest solutions come from those closest to the work. I am committed to working with our state policymakers and bringing together the people who administer elections every day to make these necessary changes. This policy optimization effort should include current and former community poll workers and frontline staff, county recorders, election directors, boards of supervisors, cybersecurity and IT professionals. These partners can identify and streamline conflicts in statutory language, recommend improvements where responsibilities overlap, and address areas where technology has outpaced the law. Our state policymakers should convene a work group to determine which statutory changes would allow Arizona to serve voters more effectively. That effort should focus on several key areas, including who selects polling locations, who operates early voting locations, who manages ballot drop boxes. A new path forward for Arizona election law is necessary. When this process is complete, those who run elections will be provided with the tools and understanding needed to operate without having the courts be the deciding factor. Arizona's election professionals have demonstrated tremendous dedication under increasingly complex laws and expectations. The answer is not more litigation. The answer is better policy. My goal is simple. Provide voters with confidence, election officials with clarity, and counties with the ability to focus on serving the public rather than resolving disputes in court. As a Maricopa County supervisor, I intend to work with our community volunteers, my colleagues, county election professionals, current and former recorders, and state lawmakers to identify statutory improvements that can be considered after the 2026 election cycle. Those discussions should occur in public and be informed by operational experience, and focus on making elections more transparent, efficient, and understandable for voters. If we work together to modernize our statutes and clearly define responsibilities, Arizona can become a national model for election administration. Good governance begins with clearly defined law, and together we can make that happen. And that was the opinion piece entitled, There is a Way to Settle Who Runs Arizona's Elections. It was written by Mark Stewart. He is a member of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. He represents District 1. He assumed office in January of 2025. He also served on the Chandler City Council from 2017 to 2024. And those were the two opinion pieces under the viewpoint section. We have a couple of minutes left. Let's read some opinions from people like you and me in the section of the paper known as the Letters to the Editor. Our first letter goes like this. As a 17-year-old high school student who will cast my first vote this November, I see Arizona's Empowerment Scholarship Account Program as a growing concern on the ballot. This program was created to help students with special needs and those in struggling school districts get access to better education. However, since the program went universal in 2022, taxpayer dollars have funded private purchases with little connection to education, including designer lingerie and trips to Disneyland. This year alone, the program is on track to cost over $1 billion, up from under $200 million before the expansion. In 2018, Arizonans firmly denied the possibility of a voucher expansion by a nearly 2-to-1 margin. 4 years later, the legislature passed a fully universal expansion anyway, making all students eligible, regardless of income and whether they had attended public school. This November, voters like me may get another chance through the Protect Education Act, a ballot initiative adding income limits and oversight to the program. Whatever you think of school choice, a billion-dollar program deserves real accountability, and voters deserve a real vote. Signed, Matthew Gaona in Phoenix. Our next letter goes, in an interview with News Nation on June 5, 2026, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche acknowledged that he is putting roadblocks in place to prevent a future Democrat administration from holding President Donald J. Trump and his minions accountable for all the illegal actions they have taken while serving in Trump's current administration. Not only does this vow seem to suggest that there are a lot of guilty and worried administration staffers, but it also ignores the reality of Trump's constitutional authority to pardon anyone he wants at any time for any or no reason. There is no doubt in my mind that Trump will sign blanket pardons for all of his henchmen before he leaves office in January 2029. Blanche does not need to put any exculpatory roadblocks in place. The only one Trump needs already exists, and he will definitely use it to protect his faithful underlings from being held accountable for their misdeeds and corruption. Signed, Ed Murphy in Mesa. Our next letter goes, as reports of New World screwworm continue to move north through Mexico, policymakers should treat this threat with the urgency it deserves. Screwworm larvae feed on the living tissue of livestock, wildlife, pets, and in rare cases, humans, causing severe injuries and major economic losses. The pest was eradicated from the United States decades ago, but recent outbreaks have renewed concerns about its return. Agriculture is a vital part of Arizona's economy, and preventing a screwworm resurgence should be a bipartisan priority. The USDA has already taken steps, including livestock import restrictions and investments in sterile fly control programs. But continued vigilance and funding are essential. In June 2025, the USDA announced an $8.5 million sterile fly dispersal facility in South Texas as part of its response effort. Protecting American ranchers, food supplies, and rural communities requires strong surveillance, rapid response capabilities, and sustained cooperation with Mexico. Waiting until screwworm reaches our doorstep would be far more costly than preventing its spread now. Signed, Aston Shaw in Tucson. At 45 minutes past the hour, we're going to move on now to the entertainment section. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. If your birthday is between March 21st and April 19th, that means you're born under the sign of Aries. Here is your today's horoscope for Aries. Are you throwing yourself into the research? A plot twist motivates you to take action. For Taurus, birthdays from April 20th to May 20th, are you sick of being overlooked and underappreciated? Well, step into your boss's line of sight. For Geminis, birthdays from May 21st to June 21st. Are you ready to transform your life? Accept an offer that gets your heart rate up. Cancer, birthdays from June 22nd through July 22nd. There's no need to engage in conflict. You have the upper hand. For Leos, birthdays from July 23rd through August 22nd. Are you steering public opinion? Use your influence. Apply subtle pressure to secure someone's support. For you fellow Virgos out there, with birthdates from August 23rd through September 22nd, are you accepting a challenge? You finally get the chance to show off your professional chops. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birthdates, are you taking a risk? Follow the pull of your passion. A gamble will be successful. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birthdates, don't take this lying down. An injustice must be faced head-on. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birthdates, find the correct angle. Choose what to conceal and what to reveal to a partner. For Capricorns, birthdates from December 22nd through January 19th, do you want a raise or consideration for a promotion? Then make your desires known. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birthdates, your charms are impossible to resist. Use your magnetism responsibly. And finally for Pisces, birthdates from February 19th to March 20th. Facing your past allows you to take the reins of your future. Those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, after a tumultuous breakup, I reconnected with two men through friends. I've known and liked them both for years. One lives in Europe. The other lives here in New York. Both are wonderful, respectful, and caring, and I feel beyond lucky. Both say they are in love with me and want to pursue a serious future. Call me crazy, but I love them both for different reasons. How do I possibly choose? Do I choose the romantic European dreamer who makes me believe in magic, but may eventually annoy me with his dreams and lack of action, plus the citizenship challenges? He's fun, romantic, spontaneous, and lets me embrace all of me. I feel so alive and loved. But I'm unsure if it would fade once kids in real life are in the picture. Or do I build a safer future with the brilliant and calming stateside friend? He's deeply empathetic, hardworking, introverted, and creative. I worry that we are only friends at our core and that I could grow bored or tired of his deep emotions. What is most important in a life partner? I'm terrified to choose the wrong one. I like who I am with for different reasons when I'm with each of them. Signed, Facing a Big Decision. And Abigail responds, Dear Facing, I'm trying to imagine how lucky enough it is to be in your position. How do I choose? I can spend my life with a romantic European dreamer who doesn't always follow through, knowing there may be citizenship challenges. What if I have kids with this adorable Peter Pan with a sexy accent? Whoa! The responsibility could be completely on my shoulders. Or Should I choose to spend my life with an empathetic, hardworking, creative man? Oh, what a hard choice to make. If you plan on having a family, one would hope you would opt for the love and stability this one would provide. Of course, how this plays out is up to you. I know whom I would choose, but perhaps my values are different. Continue seeing both of these suitors, and let them know you are seeing them both. If you do, in time, your decision may come more easily. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I am a student in high school. If I study hard now for my future, will happiness be guaranteed in the future? Is it meaningful to study if you only get stressed in the present and when you grow up in the future? I'm not sure if studying will guarantee happiness when I grow up. If I keep studying like this, will I really be happy later on? Signed, Defining Happiness in South Korea. And Abby responds, Dear Defining, happiness means different things to different people. What is important to me and makes me happy may not do the same for you or anyone else. I know that students face a lot of pressure to succeed, but the end result is usually worth it. You will be better able to provide for yourself and your family if you decide to have one. However, there are no guarantees. Remember, you can contact Abigail Van Buren by going to her website, www.dearabby.com. And now let's take a look at the Sunday comics. In the comic strip, Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, in all of the frames, Sergeant Snorkel is asleep in his sleeping bag. And we hear conversations outside his tent. Who knocked my tent down? And then another soldier says, I saw a bear over there. And Sergeant Snorkel thinks, won't those guys ever go to sleep? And the next frame, the latrine exploded. And somebody else says, I have a sinkhole next to me. And the next frame, and he's still asleep. And the next frame, there's a bat in my tent. And somebody else says, yikes, snakes. And Sergeant Snorkel is still asleep. And then in the next frame, that tree limb just missed my tent. And somebody else says, I hear wolves. And in the next frame, somebody forgot to douse the campfire. Sergeant Snorkel, still asleep in his tent. In the last frame, someone says, raccoons in the food tent. And Sergeant Snorkel's eyes pop open and he says, now I'd better get up. And that was Beetle Bailey. And then in the comic strip, Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Blondie is on the phone and it looks like she's walking out to her car. She says, oh, honey, do I ever have a super-duper surprise for you? She's holding a box, and I think there's something in it. It's got a smell coming out of it. And the phone says, really, what? And Dagwood's at home in the next frame, and we hear on the phone, it's a dessert that is out of this world. And Dagwood goes, oh, I can't wait. And the next frame, Dagwood's still on the phone, standing there by the phone, and from the phone we hear, it's called Tantalizing Triple Chocolate Parfait Paradise Overload. And Dagwood says, oh, honey, I can't wait. And in the next frame, now Bonnie's in the car. She's on her way home, but she says, I'm on my way, dear. I'm dying to sample it myself. The aroma is filling up the car. In the next frame, she's arrived home. The box is on the table. They're both standing on each side of the table. And Blondie says, it's so incredible. I worried everyone would smell it. And the last frame, Dagwood says, oh, don't worry, honey. They'll be none the wiser. In the meantime, outside the front door of their house, there's about 5 adults and 5 little kids. And they're all smelling something. And that was Blondie. And in the comic strip, Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, in the first frame, there's Zoe with one of her girlfriends, and they're coloring on the floor. And Zoe yells out, Mom, Hammy is ruining our play date. And her friend goes, yeah. And Hammy's sitting over in the side of the room, leaning against the wall, and I guess he's reading a comic book. And Mom comes in, and she says, what's he doing? And Zoe says, well, he... And her friend says, yeah. And he... And then Zoe says, but that one time he... Oh, and then the other friend says, yeah, and he probably... And they went, oh, nothing, I guess. So Mom turns and says, I thought so. And as she walks out of the room, Zoe yells, he's still doing it. And Mom says, I don't get paid enough for this. And that was Baby Blues. Well, before we go, let's wish happy birthday to some celebrities who are celebrating today. The musician Huey Lewis, he turns 76 today. The cartoonist Bill Watterson turns 68. Actress Edie Falco turns 63. Actor Dorian Wilson turns 63. And actress Catherine Erbe turns 61. And rapper Bizarre, he was with the D12 group, he turns 50 today. And TV personality Pauly D turns 46. Congratulations and happy birthday to all of them. And finally, before we go, just a reminder that if you've received your 2026 voter education guide about the election with the description of the various candidates, if the guide is too hard to read because of a disability, you can let Sun Sounds of Arizona read the guide to you at no cost to you. All you have to do is call Sun Sounds of Arizona at 1-877-361-8821. That's 1-877-361-8821. And Arizona's Sun Sounds of Arizona will read the guide to you at no cost to you. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, July 5th, 2026. Have a great day.